the Tractors. Okay. Who were they?
The band that I liked the best formed around a church, and there was a guy named Ron Getman, who's a guitar player, and he was partners with me in the church studio, and another guy named Glenn Mitchell. Ron's from Fairfax. Glenn's from Stillwater. His dad was head of the music department, and I'd known them both since my first studio in Stillwater in 73. The church studio was for sale. We formed a partnership and bought it. So they were in the band, though Glenn never played live, Ron. And then Walt Richman, piano player and co-writer. Ron co-wrote, but a main co-writer. Walt co-wrote Baby Likes to Rockin' and some others that I quite like. Casey Van Beek was the bass player, and Jamie Oldacre was the drummer.
All five of these members had played for some very notable artists.
We had five, counting me,
right.
I guess. Some of those articles that show up when you start researching the Tractors took the leap that's not true, which was session musicians. Because you get a session guy, well, he's played with 200 people, you know? I mean, yeah. That's what they do. It's not that. Like, Casey was an original sort of Eagles guy when that was forming, because he played with Linda Ronstadt and he played with the Righteous Brothers. He was the bass player singer. It wasn't like he was doing a date at 1 and then a recording date at 5. So that's Casey. Oldacre, of course, played with Leon and everybody around the church in the beginning of the Leon days, but famously played with Clapton for like 14 years. And other people. I mean, the Tulsa deal, those musicians kind of reach out. David Teagarden, as an example, who has played on some Tractors recordings and at least one live show, he was most famously Bob Seger's drummer. I, of course, played with Dylan and Ron and that group that I met when I had my first studio in Stillwater, Ron Getman and Glenn Mitchell and a guy named John Crowder, who also was from Fairfax with Ron. They were really kind of a team and just fabulous, both of them. And he was a bass player, but they all moved to the New York area, and they played with, I think Ron liked to say, the folkies, Janis Ian and Leonard Cohen. They were on some really great records of those two and played in their bands. After I'd played with Dylan, those guys were still living in the Northeast somewhere, and Leonard Cohen, who I was aware of as a wonderful songwriter, but wasn't really a target on my radar anyway, he came through, and because Ron and John Crowder were playing in his band, Charlene and I went to see this show. Dylan was there, and it was great, but it was just astounding. Another Oki influenced, you know, one of the world's greatest bands that night in California somewhere at the Wiltern Theater, I think. Anyway, so yeah, they'd all done all that stuff. When I moved back to Tulsa, Ron decided to come back to Oklahoma too from wherever they were living by New York City. I don't think they were living in New York, but Pennsylvania maybe. They moved back. Ron and I and Glenn bought that studio and started doing this and that. Ron and I produced a Freddie Fender album that's really quite great from there and never came out. And then I was still on this deal of doing the Tractors records. And so it was just demos, just me knocking out songs. And then Tim Dubois from Grove is down in Nashville doing big time stuff. Arista Records, which is Clive Davis's company, started the Nashville branch because country music, because of Garth, was exploding. You know, he told me more than once that he wasn't that interested in the job, but Clive May Dubois, president of Arista Nashville. Legend would have it, I think it's true, legend in my own mind. I wrote him a letter. I had these little demos that I'd made. Arista Records originally was founded on the success of Barry Manilow, Clive Davis being one of the old guys of the record business that was still doing stuff. He's a little younger than the ancient guys like Ahmet Erdogan and those people, but he's still one of the main cats, you know. He's really a real guy. He had discovered Barry Manilow, or for whatever reason they had a partnership. Those Barry Manilow records were big, and Arista Records became big. So Barry Manilow, good or bad, blessing or curse, I don't know. I don't care. You know, it's not something that I would have been drawn to. You know, if you're drawn to Buck Owens, you wouldn't necessarily sit around and listen to Barry Manilow all the time, though I was always intrigued. But he also came up now and then in my life as an example of pop records that I don't care for. The joke being, I wrote this letter to Tim Dubois, says something like, "Dear Tim," who I'd met in Stillwater, and that's another story, but I said, "Dear Tim, as much as I've ragged on," is really what I said in the vernacular, "Barry Manilow, I'm sure that disqualifies me from any Arista consideration. But here are these songs I'm working on. This band's called The Tractors." And he just loved the whole deal. Sent me a little money, and it took me a long time to get to the next time I sent him anything. But that's where it started, that funny letter to Tim that he probably still has, and there were many to follow. But that's the beginning of The Tractors. And then we fought and argued about everything, and it was up and down and up and down, but we did really well. And I don't think anybody, including the record label, I mean, they projected 40,000 sales. I know that, 40,000 units. It's a corporation, you know. The marketing company had to turn in projections, and then the rest of their career, based on how they do according to projections. Well, they turned in 40,000 as projected sales, and by the end of 3 months or 6 months, we had sold over 1 million records. It shocked everybody, including us.
So that was the debut album, self-titled Tractors, and it produced the single Baby Likes to Rocket.
That's right.
And it became the fastest-selling debut album from a country group to go platinum. Pretty amazing.
Yeah, amazed all of us. We'd never played, you know, just in the studio, though everybody played, of course. I have people still saying, "Oh, yeah, I remember I used to see you guys in the clubs in Tulsa." Well, I have a bad memory, but that's impossible because we never played. And it was Ron that coined the phrase platinum before playing, because I remember we had started off as 35,000 records that first week. And Tim said, "That's a pretty good start. If we hang in there, that'll be good." And then the next week was 80,000. And then it just went like that until 300,000. And we were on the CMA Awards show. That's the first time we'd really played. And we didn't really play. We just sang, but they used the track from the record, the instrumental part. I had to get up there, and we played like we played. And I looked down the front row, and Chet Atkins was sitting down there. And it was sort of like, where am I? And then it just continued on rather rapidly. And platinum before playing, we would sell a million records before we ever played a gig. And as it turns out, we did.
And then that song was rewritten as Santa Claus is Coming in a Boogie Woogie Choo Choo Train. And you sold a few of those as well.
It seemed like a good idea at the time. But I mean, I think it was.
Yeah, of course it was.
Yeah, so our second album ended up being a Christmas album. We were just riding on the bus because at that point we were playing, going down the road every night. I had a little very expensive but primitive Macintosh notebook kind of computer, and I started writing those words, and they came tumbling out, and it was pretty easy. I remember Getman really hated it, but it was easy because we just re-sang it to the same track, put it on a record, and it still does really well every Christmas. That's the thing about Christmas records. If you have a good Christmas record, it keeps coming back every year.